You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the fabulous Feinstein's 54 Below. Before we get started this evening, just a polite reminder. Please take this moment to silence your cell phones. Also, there is no flash photography, please. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
Try to catch our eye and show something that we haven't seen.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Feinstein's 54 Below podcast. We are bringing you behind the scenes at Broadway's Supper Club, and I'm Nella Vera, the Director of Marketing. Joining us today, we have Matt Dahan and Kelly Lynn D'Angelo, writers of the emotional and explosive pop rock musical Starry, about brothers Vincent and Theo Van Gogh. Following a sold-out engagement with us in 2019 and coming off their Edinburgh Fringe Festival concert series, Matt and Kelly return to Feinstein's 54 Below with a song cycle presentation of Starry. Matt and Kelly, welcome.
I'm Matt Dahan.
I'm Kelly Lynn D'Angelo.
And you are listening to the Feinstein's 54 Below podcast. Thank you so much for having us. Hi.
I guess my first question is, how long have you been working together and how did you meet?
Oh, boy. So
it's a good story, actually.
The story of how we met is, yeah, very well traveled at this point. It's I was helping a friend of mine move in to her new house in Los Angeles.
And in 2014, so yes, it's been quite some time.
And I was moving some pictures out of the moving van. And one of them was a framed print of a Vincent Van Gogh piece called Almond Blossoms. And I went to my friend, whose name was Mary. I'm like, Mary, like, you have great taste in art. I didn't know that you were a fan of Vincent Van Gogh. And she's like, oh, no, that's my roommate, Kelly. And I didn't know Kelly at the time. So I bring the work into her room.
And then I go over to him, and I'm, like, looking at the painting. And I'm like, whoa, you like Almond Blossom? And he's like, yeah, I love Vincent Van Gogh. And I was like, how funny is this? I wrote my thesis on him in college, and I'm obsessed with his story. I'm writing a musical about him right now. And then he turns to me, and he goes,
I'm doing it too.
And we, what? Yeah. And then we looked at one another over this painting. And I was like, do you want to write it together? And he just looks at me and he goes, yeah.
I'm like, oh, why not? Let's go.
That's so crazy. But yeah. What if they had been radically different?
It was the wildest thing. We compared outlines because it's an idea that I started to bring into fruition when I was about 18 years old because I had a different book and we worked on another musical together, which is an adaptation of The Count of Monte Cristo. So that was like our first project together. So at that point, I had already written the book when I was 18, and I was like, okay, next project for myself, oh, Starry. And so I started to write the outline, and then we compared them, and they were the same story, the same 5 years, the wow. same focus on Vincent and Theo in Paris and Montmartre. It was wild.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just exactly the same beats, the same everything in the outlines. And I was already starting to brainstorm ideas for music. Once we started combining our two outlines, it was like, well, there's a show here.
Amazing. So. Do you write the music and you write the book and lyrics, or how does it work?
I write the music, mm-hmm. and Cal writes the book, and together we combine on the lyrics.
I love it. I'm fascinated by how people get inspiration for shows, and this is probably the most unique way that people have been inspired. What is it? Why a musical about Van Gogh, post-impressionist artist?
I feel, and I think we both do, that so many people know the name. When you say, I love going up to people and saying, have you heard of Vincent Van Gogh? And they say, yeah. And I say, what do you know about him? And they'll say, he cut off his own ear and he painted that thing, The Starry Night. Sometimes they'll know he was in a yellow house. Sometimes they'll know a couple other details. But generally speaking, I'm like, do you know that he never sold a painting in his life? At least that's what people say. And they go, yeah, I guess I knew he wasn't really big when he was around. And I said, well, how do you think he became who he was? And that's really where, like, the discussion begins, is really about the story behind the man and the reason why his work is so transcendental and it still sparks conversations today. I like to think he's kind of somebody who sits and sat at the precipice of the material world into the emotional world. He was the access point for artists. He defined modern day artistry. So it's a really interesting story to tell.
Yeah, and the story just sings. when you know how people say that about certain stories, that you know, you pick something up, if you're going to turn into a musical, it needs to sing to you. And the story of Vincent and Theo and the whole gang there in Montmartre, it's just sang to both of us. And deep down, even beyond the core of it being about an artist and creating art, some of the most famous art in the world, it's a story about family, it's a story about friends. And once you break it down to that level, it became so relatable and so moving. Yeah, just the story of how these two brothers, even though they both died very young, how did their story persevere? That introduced us to an incredible woman named Joanna, who was the wife of Theo. And it was, she kind of carried on this story and this legacy. And this remarkable woman, she sang. You know, she needed to have a story, her story be told, because no one really knows about her at all.
No, and it's all the letters, the compilation, the person who created mm-hmm. modern day artistry wasn't just Vincent. It was really, it's really Theo's wife, Joanna, who, again, she alone defined that. Love defined that. Her passion for the story defined that. It's, as an art history major, as somebody who loves the history part of art and not something, I don't like looking at it and only object, like there's an objectiveness that's required, not a subjectiveness. And I think that we get to bring a conversation and make things emotional again. Kids walk through museums and they pass by and they just don't look twice and people don't understand the stories. But now we're getting these beautiful, beautiful essays from kids who are so excited to learn and study. And it's because we're making it alive again. These are real people. So it's exciting.
Yeah, we didn't just want it to be a story about some crusty old painters that you read about in a yeah. history book. It's when you look at it objectively, this was such an explosive and imaginative time in human history. Everything was being questioned from, you know, science to faith to art. And this was the hub of that universe. And that's where we find our characters. And that is just so much fun to write about and sing about.
And it was kind of, I like to think of it as a rebirth in some ways, or more like a, instead of renaissance, sometimes I say naissance. It's mm-hmm. just a birth, because yeah. it was 20 years of lack of war. There were people who were able to generate ideas. There were philosophers coming out. It was this really formative time where people were starting to think. You know, we were all moving forward and progressing, but suddenly people could breathe because they weren't consistently serving in different sort of wars. And suddenly the head started to grow and people started to try to think about what was next and what else could we do. And a lot of people were grasping and grabbing in different corners. And Vincent found this little nook, and it's really fascinating how he became kind of the pinnacle of artistry. It's yeah. an exciting story.
I love the story so much. I love the idea of the letters and bringing Joanna to life, and the letters, just, you know, that you pour your soul out. I guess because proximity, you're far away from your loved ones, so mm-hmm. you don't have any other way of communicating. But when you read some of the letters, they're so moving and so detailed, you know, just a biography in itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she translated it 4 different languages over the course of her life. That book took her years to compile. She was so brilliant. She was so smart.
Yeah, we can't gush over
God,
Joe
she was
enough. she is the best.
I get chills. I just got a big chill thinking about how magnificent she was. And to think about how she adapted them and how she compiled it and put it together and started to create the gallery on her own as a widow with a newborn, it's such a... we have taken so many steps. It's been such a delicate process because we care so deeply about staying true to the like fundamental emotion of these brothers. And those letters are so rich and they're so raw and they're so animated and detailed that I think we've tried in every corner of this musical to really pay homage to the legacy.
Yeah, yeah, and we're so fortunate to have these letters. Mm-hmm. I mean, without them, we wouldn't have this kind of window into, because he was not a huge critically acclaimed artist at the time. So the only way you could get this window into their lives, their relationships, their everything, were these letters.
Yeah.
And Joe was the big reason why we have this. And without that, we wouldn't be here having this conversation.
For people who maybe are not as familiar with Van Gogh's life, this idea of focusing the show on the brothers, can you talk a little bit about why a story about Vincent van Gogh can't be told without Theo?
Oh man, yeah, this
is. It should never be. I think that on every placard, I think everybody should know who.
We've seen projects where they tell Gauguin and Van Gogh, and you're like, but. You know, it seems like something's missing here.
It is.
So I wonder, you know, if you can tell our listeners what was going on in that relationship and why it was, you know, they're so intertwined, these brothers.
Okay, well, the phrase that I like to use to describe those two is a binary system. One literally could not live without the other. Vincent was not super duper close with a lot of his family. Theo was the one who really gave him the support, gave him the love financially, and he just gave him the opportunity to be the person that he became. Didn't always understand him 100 billion percent, but just like any siblings, you know, they love each other and they support each other. And it's a binary system because they just could not have been much more different.
And Theo was such an interesting person. Like,
he was an artist too.
And he did do artistry when he was younger, but from the age of like 14 and 15, they had an Uncle Saint, who oversaw this art gallery in Paris. So from a young age, the boys would go to Paris and they would tour the galleries and see all this beautiful art. And they were so focused on their family. Their father was a pastor, and so or a priest. And they would spend all this time together. And the family would do painting, and they would talk and listen to music, and they spent quality family time together every Sunday. So family was so important. But from a young age, Vincent was consistently in the shadow of other family members. For better lack of terms, there was a pretty dark moment in his past when there was another child born stillbirth named Vincent. And so he always felt like he's in the shadow of this firstborn. And it's a really beautiful and tragic upbringing. But Theo always saw beyond that. He always looked up to his older brother, as eccentric as he was, as wild as he was. His philosophy was explosive. He wanted to be a priest like his father. And so he would go around town and shout all these ideas and come up with all of these different ways to look at life. And again, that kind of put him as an outcast. But Theo just loved him so deeply. So by the time Theo was 17, he had already moved to Paris. He had been resolved by the time he was 14 to become an art dealer, just like his uncle Saint. And he was the youngest person ever in the history of Goupil and Cie Art Gallery, which was around for about 50 years, the youngest one to join. They said, yes, this kid really wants it. So by the age of 17, he had started working and selling art. And then within 10 years, right around the time that Vincent finally resolved himself after going through so many different career paths, decided, you know, when he was like in his 30s, I think I, you know, formally want to create. And I tried like 14 other things, and now I want to be a painter. Theo was so supportive of that, but also very hesitant in certain ways, where he wanted to make sure that Vincent had all of the tools and assets, and he did. But financially is really where he supported him the most, because he was so successful by the time he was 27. I could talk all day about this. Yeah, I have like a autobiography.
It's
in my
great.
Brain.
I love it. I love that story. I love just everything about his life. I also love reading about, he almost, especially I'm talking about Vincent here, there's like an innocence to him. And I guess it has to do with the way he looks at life and also physically looks at things. You know, you always wonder, Picasso, that's what he sees. You know, he sees women in these outline forms. And when you look at Van Gogh, you know, you see this is, you know, he's looking at these explosion of colors and the beauty that lies, you know, he's not looking at it with an eye like we are looking at it. And I've always been fascinated by that, you know, by artists. And when you read about him and some of the letters, there's such an innocence.
Yeah.
And optimism, which you don't expect from somebody who was so chronically depressed and obviously suffering from some mental health issues, but there's still an innocence where he describes things that are beautiful. And I find that so beautiful and heartbreaking, but beautiful. And you understand why his paintings make people so happy. Well, the ones that are not, you know, self-portraits.
Of course,
but
yeah.
I love
that. That's his power of expression. I mean, he always tried to paint what he felt, you know, not just a true image of something. He saw it with his emotions, and he translated that onto the canvas. And that's why everyone has such visceral reactions to his work, because it provokes our feelings too. And that was one of his gifts, was the ability to make us feel through his work. And I feel very deeply every time I see something of his. And that was his power to take, you know, often such immense pain and turn it into this beauty that we can all understand and enjoy even today.
That like requires that childlike innocence.
It does.
That sort of rawness and willingness. I think that people nowadays get so caught up in pleasing other people. He wanted to make other, he wanted success, but he looked inward oftentimes and then gave what was inside of himself outwardly. Instead of back in the day, all of that artwork was done and it was very regimented. It was like you painted a handful of certain topics and that was it. And for him to start to explore and ask questions, that was a child. That's like a child saying why, where, what, how. And he didn't shy away from it. He only leaned into it further. And I really think that the reason, and I think we tackled this in the story a little bit, I always feel like when people look at Vincent, they always say he's the crazy one, he's the mad one. And he has this beautiful letter that really is a big focus of us about being feeling like a caged bird. And it's the most beautiful letter that he wrote to Theo. And how he used to pass this caged bird all the time and he could hear it singing. And it should be happy because it has everything it needs, but you can just hear it in its song, I want to be free. And nowadays, people do that to him still. They look at him as a caged bird, and we want to reverse that. We're trying to set him free through this because he is so much more than
the guy who
all
cut
of
up
his
ear.
And who even knows how that all happened? There's a lot of subtext, and we want to leave that up to discussion and people's own personal interpretation. But his freedom, that's all he ever wanted. And I think that we really tried to emotionally capture that through song. We've been working on this for about a little over 3 years now,
three,
right around
three and
that.
A half,
And it's really accelerating because the story, again, we're workshopping all the time. It's really come to a beautiful place now. And we found something that I think was always there that was it was so hard to articulate. Someone would ask, well, what's it about? And I'm like, well, it's really about two brothers finding the power of expression. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Like, what do they want? So do they want to sell a painting? And it's like, no, it's not a material thing. It's about two people finding the power of expression. And really what that story is, really what we're trying to tell is the story of unconditional love. How do you express, how do you find unconditional love in somebody else enough that it transcends time? Look at where we are. Even though they died young and they never got to see and reap what was sown, it was sown.
Yeah.
So
we're still feeling that love today. And love brought us all together.
You mentioned that you're in a good spot now. So where is the project right now in terms of its development?
Oh, man. So this is probably, what, the sixth version of the show
that we have? There's a lot of versions.
Yeah. But it's we just recently released a concept recording of the big songs from the show.
And it's going viral, right?
Oh, man.
Apparently, it's been out for about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks now. We have over 500,000 views, 500,000 listens on Spotify. That's it. 500,000 listens on Spotify.
That's crazy and insane.
And we hit number 14 on the iTunes charts. That was cool. And then Billboard contacted me on Facebook.
What?
Because we're just two kids trying to tell a story.
Really know what's
so
happening.
Like they reached out to me on Facebook and they're like, you might hit the charts on Billboard. We didn't, but that was pretty cool.
Yeah,
most of this record
was recorded in a room about, you know, like this tiny, tiny room with one microphone surrounded by blankets.
Like an 8x12.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
That's so
And the fact that
incredible.
It's reaching so many people is so, it's incredible.
Well, for the score is fantastic.
Oh,
I loved
that.
It.
Thank you.
It's really good. Every time I have to listen to a musical, I pause for a minute and pray that it's good because you want all your friends and acquaintances to, you know, to do well. But this was actually fantastic. It's boppy, but it's also just, there's so much about it to love. And the score is fairly contemporary.
Yes.
So how did you decide what the sound would be? You talked about it singing, the characters and the storyline singing to you. So how did you decide on the sound?
Well, it just felt like modern music to me. I mean, Kel will tell you that early on in my original outline of this show, I originally thought, like, hey, how can I make this, you know, even cooler? How can I make it translate even more? I thought about setting it in present-day Los Angeles and making all the characters like these. You
like
know?
Silver yeah. Lake hipsters.
Yeah, like hipstery and yep. like they have the, I was very inspired.
I can see that.
I was
yeah.
very inspired by the downtown LA art scene. And I'm like, this is such a cool community. And everything was everywhere. It was exploding everywhere. And the people were incredible. And I'm like, how cool would it be to set it there? That kind of got my brain working on contemporary things. Because, you know, these are not crusty old painters. Back in the day when the story originally was taking place in the 1800s, they were like, you know, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, and during this revolutionary time, it felt like I needed, like, a rock drum set. I needed electric guitars. I needed, this was the kind of emotion I was feeling.
The brothers were all in their late 20s, early 30s. All these painters were in their late 20s and early 30s, except for Pizarro. We can talk about him another day. But there was such a zeitgeist.
Yeah.
And I think people often put them in the past and make them older than they actually were. These were young people.
Exactly. Just because they're in a museum doesn't mean they're these crusty old people.
Well,
I
think it's the beards.
Yeah. The beards does have something to do with it.
And also, you know, there is some things going around.
It's funny because I went over the summer, I went to Monet's house. You know, we were right up on his life. And I've always thought of him as this old dude with a long beard with one of those funny hats sitting outside. Of course he had a totally full crazy life before that, full of love affairs and whatever else, you know, was in his life, but you always just picture this guy with a straw hat sitting outside with his long white beard. And that's so true that in that time, and amazing that they were all contemporaries, but also makes sense that art was exploding at that time.
Yeah, and they're in the hub of the art world, Paris, and they're in like the party section of Paris, Montmartre.
Yeah.
And that's where like the Moulin Rouge was, and that's where all the big bars were, and that's where everyone went to get inspired. And all these, like, we're not making this up. All these artists are hanging out at these bars together.
Literally, where Theo's apartment was on Rue Lepic, you can walk out and Secretary's Cafe was right across.
She's one of the characters in our show. Yeah.
And that's where all the painters would hang out.
Yeah.
So Theo lived across the street.
And that's so crazy.
Tiny little street. It's crazy.
Yeah. Just all these famous artists that we look back on, we're like, it's so wild. But they were like all under the same roof a lot.
Yeah.
And they were all wild and crazy in this crazy part of Paris. Yeah.
And that actually translates a little bit back to your, when you said sound.
Yeah.
Like when we've been trying to find singers, we've been workshopping for 3 years. It was so funny because, like, a traditional sound just wasn't 100% right, but a too modern sound wasn't right either. So we had to find so many different people that worked together with different cadences and vibratos and different sort of, like, mixed belts and rock belts. It's like a combination of rawness meets refinedness. We didn't want something too clean. We wanted something that felt authentic.
Yeah, it's a story that deserved to be lush, but it also deserved to have that, like, dirt under your fingernails kind of rock edge to it, because I felt that was really true to them at the time. So I just kind of threw it all together in the music.
So you're basically translating for the audience what it would feel like at the time, which is...
Yeah, that energy, yeah.
I love that. I saw Oklahoma on Broadway,
and I
loved
it. Yes, I did, too.
And it's interesting because the Dream Ballet, which a lot of people had opinions about.
Oh, I loved it.
I love a good Dream Ballet.
You know what? I loved, and especially in talking to Daniel about it, when he said that he was trying to recreate what that moment felt like for that audience at the time, but now. Because at the time, to put in this long ballet in the middle of a musical was scandalous and people were up in arms about it. But he couldn't put another ballet in because it's expected and it's been part of that musical for 40 years or however long it's been around. And so he needed to do something that would make this audience feel what that audience felt. And I think what you're describing is kind of what that feels like to me. You're sort of incorporating the emotional sort of feeling of these artists and the time and translating it to what, you know, what it is now.
Because at the end of the day, I mean, there are artists and they did these crazy, amazing things. But at the end of the day, they were a lot more like us than I think a lot of people think. And part of my score was to kind of draw people into that world and invite them in to a world that they might feel a little excluded from if they just look at like a painting by Vincent or a painting by Gauguin. You know, this makes I want, my goal in a lot of ways is to make them feel like this is one of us.
And you're like stepping into the painting and it's inescapable kind of vibe. Like we workshopped it at Rockwell Table and Stage in late 2018. So we had 8 shows. We sold them all out, which was really exciting. There's not a lot of good selling out, so let's keep that going. but we stepped into this world and it was an immersive environment. And it felt like you were in Zygatory's Cafe because it was kind of like a cafe vibe with table service. Kind of like Feinstein's. But it's something that I think, like in Oklahoma, they did such a great job of really making you feel like you were there and everything was everywhere. And I think that's something that this show, you can, like when you listen to it, when you listen to Matt's brilliant music, you step into it and you can just imagine it all around you. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's just viewed like a painting. It's something that's like experienced.
You mentioned the cast, and we noticed that some of your cast members are StarKid members.
Oh,
so what
yeah.
made that connection? How did you end up with that?
Long journey. It's a interesting road with that.
It started very early on with before we even had finished Act One, really. I mean, we wanted to do some concerts to just dip the toe in the water with the songs, make sure they were good, make sure an audience responded. And Kel was showing me a bunch of people. And Jamie Lynn Beatty is a StarKid member, and I didn't know anything about Team StarKid at the time.
Maybe I knew a little bit.
I only just found out about them and realized, oh my God.
They are the most incredible community of artists and creators and fans, and it's so crazy that I didn't know anything about them because now I'm their music director, which is
nuts. Wow.
I've out in LA, they're based in LA now, and music direct their shows.
Yeah. But booked them at 54 Below, and they said, oh, could we do a week? And we were like, oh, a week is for like, you know, Kelly O'Hara, who can sell out and has a fan base. And we put their show on sale, 2 performances. How quickly did we sell out? Like, I don't even want it. I mean, I think it crashed our servers. Yeah. And then we were like, who are these people? And then we realized the power of YouTube.
Oh my God. They own YouTube.
And now we've added performances. They're still all sold out. We just added one more performance on Friday, and that's been sold out. And we're getting sob stories and letters from mothers saying, please, my child, we're flying out and we didn't get tickets. Or my child is their biggest fan and we got main dining room seats, but we have to have ringside seats. And I'm like, relax. It's 24 feet from the stage to the back of the venue. Your kid is going to be fine. Aww. You will still be able to see the pores on their faces. Like, I've never seen anything like it.
It's like a zeitgeist. It's this generation. I'm gonna say it for myself, of millennials who were actively searching for musical theater that spoke to them. And when they started making stuff in the early,
you know, the parodies, right?
Yeah, when they started making the parodies, it was so brilliantly written and so raw.
It was a perfect storm.
Yeah, it was just what people were looking for at the
it's
time.
Incredible.
I mean, it was the dawn of YouTube. And their first, you know, big thing was Very Potter musical. And they're like, well, we don't have the rights to this, so why don't we just release it on YouTube and see what happens? And now look, 11, 12 musicals later, they're still going stronger than ever.
Didn't take it down.
No.
No, well, it's a parody.
It's a
parody. Protected.
Yeah,
under
it's a parody.
The Constitution of the United States of America.
Yeah, parody law. Thank you.
But it's wild because Jamie got involved very early on, and then we needed at some point a Vincent, and she, I reached out, and she was like, well, I have these 2 guys, Jeff and Dylan, and I was like, oh, yes. And
two other amazing star kids,
And we brought them in, and then we started workshopping with them in late 2017, and really since then, they've been involved in different capacities. It's funny, because in early 2017, right around that same time, is when we found Mariah as well. Who was in an interesting place where she was moving to do more directing because she's brilliant in so many different ways. But she started to lean again back into our workshop and really started to get involved with Starry. And then StarKid started working with her, and we started working with more StarKids. And now it's been like this beautiful intersection and dance.
Now we can't get away from each other.
It's amazing. You know, I've watched the YouTube videos of them performing, and they're really good.
Seriously
good cast.
Mm-hmm. And I love that they're young because, again, I was expecting to see some old bearded, white bearded guy singing your song. And it's, you know, a young man in his prime. And you're like, okay, you know, I know where this show's going. And it's kind of awesome. So you've done, in addition to Starry, you've both worked on The Count of Monte Cristo. Story is based in the 1800s.
In France.
What draws you to this time period?
It seems like we have a little
Not that it
here.
Isn't a great a great period. I love the period. Also, I love France and a Francophile. But what draws you to this time period?
Oh, well, Cal, you want to take this one?
Yeah. I mean, I love history. I have a cultural anthropology art history degree. Like, I was obsessed with, like, 19th century literature. I found The Count of Monte Cristo when I was, like, in ninth grade, when I was 14, and that's when I started writing the book for my adaptation of The Count, simply because after I read the novel, I was just so blown away by the fact that something written by Alexandre Dumas back then could just resonate with me so much. I think the thing that I love the most about writing stories in the past, not to say that we won't tackle other things, they're so grand. And they allowed you to step and create such a beautiful world. And to make something that once felt dead alive, there's such a beauty in that, because growing up, I really loved school. I really loved learning. I loved growing my mind. I liked reading. To make history accessible, I mean, heck, Hamilton just blew it out of the water with that. When I was 7 years old.
And now six.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To Broadway.
Six. There's just, it's all happening now.
Yeah, and it's great.
When I was 7 years old, my favorite musical in the world, I live in LA, I work in TV film, I'm a writer right now at Disney, which is cool. But while I was working, while I was working out there, people, you know, when you take these big meetings, they're always like, oh, where, you know, what's your favorite movie? And they expect you to say an art film. And I say,
I knew this was going to come up.
I have to mention
it. I knew
it
was going
to
come up.
I have to. It defines me. Rodgers and Hammerstein's 1997 version of Cinderella featuring Brandy as Cinderella. Best thing that was ever made. Because I was 7 years old and I saw it. And then I saw how the cast was just beautifully colorblind. To make worlds based in the past where if it's not race-related or sex-related, you can remove the barriers of sex and race and just tell a story with anybody who can tell it. I think it's such a beautiful sort of world that you're able to kind of revitalize and make it less stuffy.
But also for people who claim that there were no black nuns in Austria or, you know, it's like Dumas was black.
Yeah.
Yep.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think people don't realize that.
Knowledge
and you're
is
like,
power.
And, you know, Norm Lewis, when I interviewed him, said that when people were criticizing that, you know, he was playing Javert and there would be no black policeman. He was like, there was a general who was black and his name was Dumas. Mm-hmm. So I think that part of it is interesting. Last question, since we are at time. You're both based in Los Angeles. You work in film and animation. What are your other projects that you're working on outside of theater, musicals?
Oh, man. Well, right now I'm just all about theater and musicals. I mean, as music director for Team Star Kid, I helped get their latest show, Black Friday, on stage, which is going to be on YouTube. They stay true to their YouTube roots. It's going to be on YouTube on the Leap Day, the 29th of February. Yep.
Excellent. Mm-hmm.
Releasing that. And I also produced their record.
So all of their more recent music.
So the music, I'm the music guy. I'm their toolbox for music. That's been taking up all that
time. Such an empire.
It's surprising, but once you get into the Star Kid ecosystem, it's just all over the place. And then before we know it, there's going to be another Star Kid show that they're going to start putting out there very soon. So I'll be jumping into that one and music directing and doing all their sheet music, running rehearsals, all that business. So lots of music directing for me.
Great. And then I wrote on Cartoon Network's Mau Mau, and stay tuned for some stuff I did on Nickelodeon. You'll see my name there. And then this beautiful kids show that I've been working on. I don't know if I'm allowed to say the name yet, but it has been announced in terms of the actual show. So it's called Chicken Squad Season 1. It's a fantastic show.
Wow.
It's so cute, and I get to write the lyrics to some of the songs, and it's just, it's such a dream to be able to write kids' content. I also do a lot of podcasting, and I do live streaming. I'm a very weird multi-hyphenate, and I'm a professional dungeon master. So you can I play D&D professionally. It's the weirdest world.
That
so,
is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
I know.
And I love it.
It is now it's a job. Amazing. But I am the DM for Girls Gets Glory, and I'm one of the players on Sirens of the Realm, and I do a bunch of other stuff with D&D. So you can always find me in that game space.
Amazing. This is so great. Thank you guys so much for joining me. We look forward to seeing Starry, not just at Fine Science 54 Below, but also hopefully somewhere on stage, fully produced very soon.
We're hopeful.
Because it's a great show. So
we won't stop until it happens. I promise you. Great.
What happens when we die? The answer's in
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.